Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Chasing the Sun, Chapter 26, Talk of the Day. Now, what's happened here is that I read it, and then my dictaphone was off, so I hadn't actually successfully checked that I was recording. So, that's meant that I've read it before. And as I read, I became extremely tired, yawned, and had a sleep amongst all those things, done some work, come back. And so we have this unusual thing, is that I've actually read ahead of the chapter, ahead. And the chapter is all about the sun and music and mostly opera. And I get this feeling that when you speak to these people who are wine and cheese, fine wine to wine cheese and stuff like that, their sort of antenna for discussion is very limited. If you try and talk about the texture of cheese, the temperature of cheese, besides what side of the hill it came from, what animal, you know, the traditional, they're connoisseurs, but connoisseurs are very much not going very much beyond the analytical aspect of it. And obviously it's very hard to write in a book about the sun, the analysis of it, but there's not there's not that high level of stuff. There's name dropping. I've seen this. I'm a cultured person that's coming across. I'm not criticizing that. It's just that people that you speak with that, they don't have a, you know, unfortunately, they don't have a great depth of it. I must admit the difference is there. So the, chief, conductor of the Penrith Opera. He sounds great, but then you check what he said, and he's just reciting Wikipedia to you. There's no deeper analysis for it. No, he himself doesn't fall into Wikipedia. He quotes other people who've spoken to him, and they have obviously read from Wikipedia. So it's a bit sad. If there's any problem with that. Now, also in here, you can see some structural elements. He introduces a narrative of writing a conversation with this Chilean woman, and in a true artistic form, he develops the story of this Chilean woman getting ever sicker and sicker, and she disappears. Then it's not rounded off, but at least you can see the paintbrush stroke in terms of he's written the first draft, and then said, "Look, I want to drag this element backwards and sing it together." And with this element mask, the fact that I am just randomly popping in, you know, he randomly pops in. It's the opera he considers is the random opera selected by this Chilean woman. I want to go. There's no systematic version, so it's a veneer. So you wouldn't be able to say write this in a university thesis. But let's go through it. It's chapter 26, page 465 of this massive tome I'm getting through. I'm more than halfway through. And the title is Talk of the Day. Now, the prince in Puccini's Turner Dot from 1926. Now, I didn't realise that Puccini was, you know, post-World War I, all that type of stuff. But he says, the prince says, "At the rising of the sun, I shall triumph, I shall triumph." Whatever that means. And then attributed to George Turner and Bet Mattin, circa 1934, that is, we're not sure whether they stole it. "There's a house in New Orleans they call the Rising Sun. It's been the ruin of many poor girl and me, a god for one." So that's, of course, referring, I think, as we find out, to a brothel, even though I didn't quite know the house. Rise and sun. Okay, let me read this. "In the autumn of 2003, I submitted a letter to the New York Times Book Review outlining my search for information about the sun." Gee whiz. I just feel that I've passed a... No, it's one of these horrible things with the cognitive stuff. You think you're going well, and then people say, "Hey," and they can't actually hear what you're saying. So you think you're speaking well, but you're not. A few days after this was published, this letter was published, the telephone rang and I found myself talking to Gabrielle Rupik, professor of opera at the New School, the university founded in Greenwich Village in 1919 with old world courtesy. said she would be happy to advise me about the sun in opera and the classical music. So it's beautiful. You know, I found myself talking, you know, the phone ring. Oh, look, I found myself. What a beautiful way of placing him. I thanked him, and the old world in the new world, so the new school, new school, old, is beautiful, balanced writing. She's a fantastic writer. I thanked her, noticing her strong foreign accent, and we agreed to meet. Could I come to where she lived on New York's Upper West Side? There's some beautiful English. What beautiful reconstruction. Her apartment turned out to be a three small rooms. So here's the questions leaded, and you've got the idea of, can I visit the rooms? Yes or no? And then it comes, a bird-like Chilean in her mid-80s. She was a dramatist. One of her nine plays, White Butterfly, appears in the 1960s best short plays of the year. But such writing was behind her now, and opera her love. Not being in the best of health, she found it hard to get around. So over the next few months, I would take the trip to the 22nd floor of her apartment building while she slowly made tea before we settled down to talk about opera and watch many video recordings which she expertly fast-forwarded to scenes she wanted to discuss. Beautiful structure. You cannot get a beautifully more structured thing. She explained that opera was a rarefied art form, the preserve of composers from just a handful of countries, Italy, France, Germany, England and Russia, notably not USA or America, or Australia. With mid to late 19th century, its golden age dominated by Wagner and Verdi. Their works and those of their contemporaries often invoke the sun, she said, generally in the context of young love. None is more tragic than Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's The Snow Maiden, 1800 to 1801. This is really interesting because the opera plots, even though it's high music, has got the same structure as a DC comic, you know. DC comic in terms of their fantasy people, they can fly and do all these stupid things, you know. No others that she could think of make the sun an actual character in the action. The doomed heroine, Winter's daughter, falls catastrophically in love with the sun in Act 4, as dawn is breaking over the valley of the sun god. The snow maiden calls to her mother, who warns her to stay out of his light. But before the snow maiden can enter the protecting forest, Mizgir, a local merchant, as they are. I love the hapless men coming across these things. And this is the term voyeurs of us ugly old men looking at fantastically beautiful young women appears. And soon she is presenting her as the bride to the Tsar. Just as she declares her love, a ray of sunlight falls over her and she melts away. Isn't that beautiful? Completely bizarre. You feel so ripped off. What? In his memoirs, Kim Afkas mentions his interest in folk song and how he was, quote, captivated by the poetic side of cult sun worship and sought its survivals and echoes in both tunes and the words of songs. These occupations subsequently had great influence in the direction of my own activity as a composer, but of that later. Sadly, that is all he writes of his solo enthusiasms until the last of his 15 operas, first performed in 1909, The Golden Cockerel, from the folktale retold of Pushkin, when the Japanese queen sings a hymn to a star. To lead me further into the sun's association with tragic love, Gabriella puts on one of her recordings, La Boheme, by Guglielmo Puccini, 1858 to 1924. Soon I was watching Act 1. In which Mimi, the seamstress hamstrung coughing her life away, has just met Rodolfo, an impoverished poet from the room above. Mimi's candle is blown out. She can imagine coughing. She asks Rodolfo to relight it. He then goes back into her room, only to return a few seconds later to say, "I've lost my key." Both their candles are extinguished by draught. Oh no. And the young pair stumble about in the dark with inevitable consequences. Obviously not, it wouldn't be like our sex scenes at the moment where they have a mandatory penetration and stuff like this. Yes, they call me Mimi, she begins, but my name is Lucia Light. And when the thaw comes, April's first kiss is mine. I am the first to see the sun. They vow to remain together when the world returns to life, comes spring. In Act 4, obviously, in her dying aria, Sona dite figurita domia, where have I gone? Where they have gone, I was pretending to sleep. Mimi revives the moment of their meeting, the sun's first mind. The scene must have been thrillingly performed in La Scala, with the first five tiers done up in sun red and yellow. Nor is La Bikini's only work of solar imagery. More than any other composer, he scatters his opera with references to the sun, such arias as Manon Lequette, Tosca, which apparently Tosca's pretty funny, Madame Butterfly, and the turn light. It's here, it's before the electronic age, but with the printing press of composition. It's just so fantastic to hear. When I next visited Gabriella, she was discovering for a fall and finding it an effort even to make her way across a few feet from her chair to the video collection. This time I made tea while she put on Puccini's single act work, Sister Angelica, the title character in a girl who was born a bastard child. I'm sure my brain is full of information, but I don't know where it's from. Bastard child being sent to a convent to spend the rest of her life doing penance for being a bastard child like that. And the opera opens on a lovely evening in May. Sister Angelica and the other nuns have gathered to celebrate one of the 3 days of the year when the setting sun turns the fountain in their courtyard to gold, representing the fair smile of Our Lady. The point I sort of pondered first reading through this is the problem of illuminating something three times a year. I could imagine it possibly twice a year, or there'd be three holes. It's a bit hard to see it. But just as the opera's opening scene is lit by sun, so too is the climate, as Angelica implores the Virgin for forgiveness in the blaze of light. She takes poison and suicide, sorry. By the end of the opera, Angelica, hearing that her child has died, takes poison. So Sister Angelica So she's born a child out of wedlock. So that's the problem. That's the problem. So she's, and they put her into a thing. I thought the child, she was the bastard. The bastard is the term of endearment in Australia. The Virgin, in a blessed light, appears as a sign of mercy granted her so she can die. What a fun opera. Okay. Now I better get in to see, I might read another paragraph of this. And there's a fair number of pages to go. The sun, as a sign of infinite goodness of God, is a theme taken up by another great composer who made the star his leitmotiv, Richard Wagner, 1813-83, in Das Rheingold in 1869, the first of four parts of Der Ring der Nibelung. It's fun to read Wagner because it's together. But it's horrible to read the original legend, The Ring of the Nibelung, because it just goes through. It would fascinate a German, a hut in the freezing cold and all the Germans speaking German about it. It would be fascinating to hear, but nowadays it's horrible to listen. The lustful dwarf Albrecht, who's the Jewish person, sets out with the three maidens who guard the gold at the bottom of the Rhine. Look, sisters, the sun shines into these depths and it's what gleams and glisters there. The maidens know all too well that what they are protecting, and even as they repel the dwarf's advances in turn, Rheingold, we delight in your glow. German, German, German. His desires thwarted, Albert steals the maiden's precious sword from which he casts the enchanted ring. Thus, the sun and the gold blend into talisman of ancient power. Significantly, Wagner wrote Libretto of the cycle at the time of the first three gold rushes. I think that's really underselling the whole complexity. I like the Rheingold gets cast, Brunhilde's wedding ring as she rides into the funeral pyre. She goes, oh, it's how Germanic can you possibly get romantic? I'll ride in, and the Rheingold melts and goes back into the Rhine. But you've got also that the fire wounds and vault and stuff like that. Okay, so I'll stop here for a quick while just to check how everything's going to get ready for dinner. Okay, thanks a lot, and I'll be back soon. Okay, starting up reading after a little break again, sort of, I suppose, 12-hour break. I hope that I can still improve. I'm still aiming every time to improve reading and comprehension. So, we're talking about the Rheingold and Wagner, and it's hard to see the link between the Rheingold and the actual the sun. Yes, it's hard. Having read that, I didn't pick up the sun. I got, the Wanderer and the fireworms that the Wanderer used to go around the place. It was, in terms of an opera, it's heavy to listen to and pick up, and obviously it's in a foreign language, but there are these sort of themes running through and this epic stuff where they, I don't know, compared to the actual Nibelungen legend, which goes on forever and ever, it stops and going on forever and ever. I suppose in terms of editing, nowadays it wouldn't work as a film because it's got too much content in it. I don't know. Okay, now with the hero, Siegfried takes the center stage in part 3. He comes upon his sleeping Brunhilde and awakens her with a kiss just as the sun rises. Most of Siegfried's orchestrated gloomy minor chords, but at this point the violin section enters on high notes, with inwind instruments taking up the first two chords, leading on strings to yet higher register and notes of harp. As Brunhilde, dazzled by the morning light, cries, "Sun, I greet you, light, I greet you, radiant day," the vivid combination of instruments employed to celebrate the sun is all its glory, is an extraordinarily rare in music. I think I've done this part again. Yet, in Tristan and Isolde, Wagner alone and all composers has his hero inveigh against the sun. That's pretty interesting. And this is it. I can't read it. Okay. And, yeah, I just trying to remember bits and pieces of Schopenhauer and stuff like that. Which even at night kept me from her. Ah, Isolde, sweet beauty, when at last, oh, when will you extinguish your spark, that I may know my fortune, the light, when will it be extinguished? Now, it's really interesting that in that, in all of this, you've got to remember that there wasn't a lot of advertising, the access to sort of feminine sort of romance and stuff like that was only through opera, so that's why it can't compete nowadays. Okay, the sun may indeed be the symbol of civilization, right living, but Tristan rejects it all, giving himself Nachtstrick, night vision. Here, Wagner invokes familiar conflict going back to at least Egyptian myth, which opposes the forces of Horus and the sexuality of Seth. Okay. Others followed his lead. Charles Ingold's Romeo and Juliet, the chorus sings, "The Romeo love thrives in the shadows, let it guide his steps." Then, to take instances from popular music, "Today, my enemy, the night, my friend. When the sun goes down, I'm alone with you all through the night." Sky Masters and the Guys and Dolls, "My time of day is the dark time, and the creature of the night, and Edith, and that creature of the night, Edith Piaf, catching sight of the morning, said, 'Au revoir, le soup.' There's the son of a bitch." Edith Piaf's a very fascinating person. Okay. Tristan is old as a love is doomed by the world that cannot allow it to flourish. Only under cover of darkness can they meet as lovers amid many exchanges about their hatred of daylight's false values, their devotion to Das Wunderlichte Nacht, the wonderful realm of night. As the conductor Karl Macaras has pointed out, the music matches the libretto. The orchestration is bright and glaring for the vanity and deception of the day. Then suddenly it becomes nocturnal and shadowy.
Galbraith explained that the lovers refrain from coursing daylight, so it pervades the opera that it acquired the name Tastbrichter, the call of the day. Wagner had been initiated into the darkness dialect in the writings of Arthur Schopenhauer, 1788 to 1860. So it's pretty interesting that, you know, Australia was just working out how to incarcerate each other and stop each other. It's really interesting in that you look at comparative history, where while Europe was exploring the Enlightenment, we were exploring the sort of consequences of the Enlightenment, the counter-Enlightenment. I think Australia, or my view is Australia is a counter-Enlightenment society. That is, good ideas cannot get going in it because we have got counter-Enlightenment viewpoints instilled by it. So the Enlightenment flourished, and it's sort of like a failed Enlightenment experiment in Australia. Okay, let's read this scene. In particular, The World and the Will and Representation, 1819, which Wagner describes the autobiography as having an impact on him, was extraordinary and decisive for the rest of my life. Tristan, which he composed just 2 years after he read Schopenhauer, is the quote of the light and darkness of the two books' most important concepts. Those are phenomenon and nomenon, the former being our false perception of the world, while the real is nomenon, where all things are indivisible one. Most people live in the world of the day, but a small elite, of whom Tristan is one, sees beyond the chimera of another world, at once more terrifying, more reality, and ultimately offering deeper satisfaction. For it is there that he can forever be united with his love. Tristan is aware that the realm of night can be shared only in the fullest sense when he and Isolde die. Thus, Tordegildus has a death-consecrated heart. He repetitiously sings, "Now we are becoming the devotees of night. Spiteful, with envy armed, could still deceivingly keep us apart, but never again delude us." Now, it is interesting that we have people, I think the Americans finish their dramas where people either get married or get incredible wealth or beat someone or survive. In operas, people tend to resolve things by dying. Okay. One of the greatest pieces of music of all Western culture is a direct Attack on the Sun, possibly, which may be why Tristan has been denounced as a work of against civilization. Gabriela suggested that, this is the, I think, the Chilean person, that our next meeting, oh, so be moved backwards in time to Mozart in 1756-91, who, when his greatest, he went so far to change many elements of the fairy tale that inspired one of his greatest opera in order to wrest it from being a celebration of the sun, the magic flute. So that's something I do want to read. There's some beautiful pieces in the magic flute. Mozart composed the opera The Year He Died, the libretto, by his old friend John Joseph Schneiderpfeiffer, 1751-1812. It's based on a story set in Egypt in which the Queen of the Night represents the power of good, and the black-skinned, black-hearted monstratus is that of evil. Mozart and Schubert reversed the Queen's character, making her the symbol of wrongdoing, and added a figure of Sosastro, an all-wise high priest, of the sun Isis. Sastro, his name being derives from Zarathustra, that's Zarathustra, which is really interesting. I'll have to read Nietzsche, that's wrote Zarathustra, has taken the princess Pamina to the temple of the sun to release her from the evil influence of her mother, Queen of the Night, who in turn induces the noble young prince Tamer to search out and liberate her daughter, with the promise that he will be given her hand in marriage. Timo, after manifold trials in which his character is tested by Zastro, not only learns the truth about the fell queen, but gains both Parmenio's freedom and her love. In a climax scene, the couple are then welcomed into the Temple of the Sun. Wow. I think I'm going to have to read that. I never quite understood the opera. The South African director, William Kinrich, was declared that there are references throughout the opera turning darkness into light of light of the sun banishing the night. And certainly the sun has more than just a shine on roll. Act 2 opens the forest of palms of golden leaves, amid which rises a great pyramid surrounded by thrones of 18 priests of the sun. And for the finale, the stage transforms into a sun. The star even has its own key, C major, being used throughout the embodied soul to embody solar radiance. Mozart, Schikaneder were Freemasons, and Masonic elements appear throughout. None of them more central to the Masonic system than the sun. The music historian William Mann argues Mozart was interested in forging a link between Freemasonry of his time and ancient Egypt, from which Masonry claimed its original derivation. So it's really a religious work, isn't it? This opera, of all works of art, exalts the sun specifically because of its significance so long established in the secret society. A Masonic encyclopedia published in 1912 explains why. Hardly any of the symbols of Masonry are more important in their significance or more extensive in their application than of the sun, so you have the all-seeing eye, I suppose, in the pyramid. As a source of material light, it reminds the Masons of intellectual life in which he is constant search. The sun is presented to us in the Masonry's first as a symbol of light, but then more emphatically as a symbol of sovereign authority. Precisely such thinking informs Mozart's opera, although one may be given for escaping to the music. Yeah, that's interesting. I suppose it's interesting to me that Mozart was around at the founding of Australia. Okay, so which gives you an idea that Australia was just surviving, doing stupid stuff. Although many other works find one way or another to pay homage to the sun, Gabriella and I largely kept classical opera, partly because that was her preference, partly because she was recovering slowly from a fall and I was anxious not to tire her, which is interesting because this is a complex thing to go through, and he's using this person as a motif. The Sorrows of Young Weather by Jules Mansett, 1842 to 1912, from Goethe's novel, in which the main aria in Act 2 is Sophie's Du Gatsol, Plein de Flamme, Petrio McGinsey's Iris, Innocence and Desire in the Turn of the Century, Kyoto, written in 1897, several years before Madame Butterfly, with its aria Laura, Son Lola Vita. Umberto Gano's opera Andre Schinner, about the brilliant young poet who perishes under the reign of terror. The Cunning Little Vixen by Leo Jardek, with a sunrise sequence. Memorably, in Beethoven's Fidelio. That's right. Again, the prisoners emerge from their dangerous dungeons, blinded by the sun. He really should mention Plato's The Cave, because the sun and knowledge is there in Plato. Plato does mention the sun a fair number of times. By the sun's light, it is seen as life-giving, so the Act 2, Fortison sings of how its deprivation makes him feel he's in hell. It is, of course, easier to track connections to the sun in opera than in musical forms without words. The sun is hard to represent in notes alone, but many compositions invoke it in their titles. Nature permeates the music of Frederick Dayes, whether the ocean in the sea drift or the mountains of the meadows of Massive Life. He was a sun-worshipping pagan at home, writing about the passing of nature to daffodils. Several severed relationships, songs of sunsets, or simple mortality, songs of farewell, a late lark. And equally obsessed with spring and summer, a sense of sun seems presented in even his untitled pieces. Dayes was composing at a time when it was considered vulgar to produce sensory effects for program music. That did not daunt his contemporary, Joan Sibelius, 1865 to 57. She was. In the final movement of his fifth symphony, there appears to be a wonderful representation of the sun. Alex Ross, in an extended critical appreciation of the Times, in the New Yorker, describes the climax of the swan hymn that runs through the symphony. Well, jeebus, I thank goodness I haven't wiled my way away listening to this type of stuff. The swan hymn, now in the final movement, carried by the trumpets, undergoes convulsive transformations that is reborn as a fearsome new being. Its intervals split wide open, shatter and reform. The cymbals end, but with six far-flung chords through which the main theme shoots like a pulse of energy. The swan becomes the sun. Well, there are things I've listened to, and I'm going, what the heck? And people go, oh, it's great, let's sip some Chardonnay. Oh, fantastic. It sounds like a car crash, a lot of these things to me. The star inspired by the works of Sibelius, including A Song to Sunrise. Solar elements appear in many other classical works, including music by Maurice Ravel, Claude Debussy, and Igor Stravinsky. One afternoon, Gabrielle made up a list. It ranged from also Sibelius, A Brief Opening and Prologue, Sunrise, by Richard Strauss, 1896, to Eternity's Sunrise of John Chaffinet, 1999. Based on the poetry of William Brake and my own favourites, the opening sunrise movement of Dvorak's Ninth Symphony, 1893, and Elker's Chalcedon de Matin, and Hillis Overture by Carl Nielsen, all composed within 10 years of one another. I just have to say, it does strike me that he would be ultimately soul destroying because he would be interested, I was thinking of the author coming in here to beat this person. So, no, it just, you wouldn't be able to get beyond people's egos, I think, reading it. The majority of works are inspired by sunrises rather than sunsets, or by the star's internal works. What? Just because the work mentions the sun, the title does not necessarily mean that it actually relates to it. Hayden, in 1732 to 1809, titled one of his string quartets, Sun Quartets, though it contains nothing particularly sunlight. Gustav Holst exercised the sun from his best-known work, the Orchestral Suite de Parts, 1914-16. The music was partly inspired by his horoscope scout, which dealt with the seven influences of destiny and constituents of our spirit. But he chose to replace the sun and the moon with Uranus and Neptune, which is obviously is not an horoscope, is it? Because they're only visible with telescopes. In earlier choral hymns from Riga Viga, however, he did include the hymns to Venice, Sun Rising Through the Mist. I left for several weeks before I next went to Gabriella. Okay, so we know this is going to finish off Gabriella. But had come across something during my researches that I knew would interest her. A curiosity from Sergei Pokarev, 1891-53. Although not a musical work. In 1916, shortly after composing his first two piano concertos, he acquired a sun coloured notebook in which he asked people to write their answers to a single question. What do you think about the sun? He kept the inquiries until 1921, by which time The Gambler, 1916, and The Love of Three Oranges had brought him fame. There are 48 pages, all told, now in the Moscow Museum, which include answers not just from his friends but acquaintances, but from people he had encountered in his travels. Okay, this is before the revolution, isn't it? No. Yeah, it's after the revolution. It's hard to imagine this is still going on. From the likes of Arthur Rubinstein, Fyodor Chaplin, Vladimir Mayakovsky, Igor Stravinsky, I enjoyed many of the answers, such as Mandowski's, from all of you who soaked in the sun for plain fun, who spilled tears for centuries while you cried, I walk away and place the monocle on the sun into my gaping, wide-open eye. Dears. And Stravinsky direct, it's very stupid that the Germans, in German, the sun is of the feminine and not masculine gender. Okay, well, that's a bit bizarre. Looking forward to showing Gabrielle some of the material from the notebook, I checked at the desk in the ground floor of her block and asked if I could go up to the apartment. The receptionist looked at me in perplexed. Miss Rosbeck is not here, he said. She had all her things packed 3 weeks ago and returned to Chile. She won't be coming back. I turned and headed for the door. I knew why she had gone home. Presumably to die might be the answer. Unfortunately. Thanks to the power of Google, we know that 2,642 copyrighted songs have Sun in their title. More by now, as a figure from Sumay from 2009. The roster of composers ranges from Beethoven to Ivan Berlin and includes 99 songs featuring the phrase Rising Sun alone. When in early 1970s the Beach Boys recorded I Follow the Sun, they were reflecting at least a decade of craze of doing exactly that, principally on great surfing beaches in Southern California. To the Beach Boys, the sun stood for freedom. From the mid-1960s to the mid-1980s, it became a metaphor of choice of expressing the ups and downs of love. Katrina and the Waves, Anthem or Walking on Sunshine, seized upon the change of sunlight to the charge of sunlight to express the intensity of love. Bill Withers' Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone captures the agonies of love lost, while the Beatles' Good Day Sunshine joined being in love with the feeling of being merged with the world. One of the best-known songs of the decade uses a different kind of metaphor. Here Comes the Sun, composed by George Harrison in 1969, to become the opening track of the two-side Beatles Abbey Road album. It has its genesis in collaboration with his friend Eric Clapton, and celebrated the escape he longed for during the time when so many things were sapping his energy. Primarily, the grueling shifts to finish the album before the Beatles broke up. The phase reflected Harrison's relief when each session was over. As he put it, the song was written at a time when Apple, whatever that means, was getting like school. Also, it would be Apple, Abbey Road? Oh, okay. We had to go in and be businessmen, sign this and sign that. Anyway, it seems that if winter in England goes on forever, by the time spring comes along, we really deserve it. So one day, I just decided I was going to slag off Apple, which is Apple Road, and went over to Eric Clapton's house. The relief of not having to go and see those dopey accountants was wonderful. I also walked around the garden with one of Eric's acoustic guitars and wrote Here Comes the Sun, asterisk. The second great Sun classic in the pop era, The House of the Rising Sun, originally an English ballad, it took the title from the euphemism for brothel, so that the extent is not about the sun at all. But as a cultural reference point, it is unique. In 2005, a poll ranked Britain's fourth favourite song of all time, and the worldwide popularity has not been far behind. What was the Rising Sun? Possibly a metaphor for slave pens in the American South, or Plantation House, or even Plantation itself. As for being a particular place in New Orleans, nothing is certain. Oh well, okay, he's having a bit each way. Along with all this music, it either invokes the sun or has been inspired it, a slew of modern-day compositions attempts to capture what it actually sounds like. The Sanford Soul Center for California lists a dozen artists who have attempted to do representation. Stephen Taylor, for instance, has composed Shattering Suns and Symphony inspired by images of celestial catastrophe with music built on breathing the sounds of the sun, as recorded by Stanford Soul researchers. So Stanford was a railway millionaire and played by a synthesizer. Musicians have moved from the inner realms of imagination. Mozart's noting C representation of sun, for example. Presumably because he felt the key resonated with the kind of solar energy and optimism to the representation drawn from science. This doesn't necessarily mean such competitions have any claim to accuracy or that anyone, even now, for all our sophisticated technology, can actually know what the sounds sound like. Well, I think you should describe what you're watching. We can actually see the sun vibrate like a cymbal. We can actually, I can, even though it's space does not convey sound, I could hear what an astronaut is speaking by shining a laser on his helmet and watching the Doppler shifts of his helmet. So we can hear a sun through space. We can actually see the Doppler shifts inside. In 1992, the prolific Danish composer Paul Rotters, inspired by Carl Nielsen's Hairless Overture, created a synthetic drama, Gong, with this, oh, that sounds awful, a score meant to evoke what scientists has told us. He explained that recent research has shown the sun's surface reverberates like a gong in four different simultaneous tempi. Well, dear. Formally, his composition follows the sun through its lifespan, from explosive birth through the hyperactive release of energy we know today to final collapse, concluding with a chord taken from the middle piece and sustained over several bars, for virtual nothingness to full force. I confess to finding the symphony difficult to listen to, and it turns out that it's not accurate rendering in any case. From 2006 on, a new discipline of heliosismology has been measuring the super-low frequency sound waves that echo inside the sun, caused by waves bouncing around the inside of the giant ball of gas. Huge convective bubbles, well, plasma, I think they are plasma waves, I don't think, yeah. Huge convective bubbles of different notes and vibrations, nearly all thousands of times slower in pitch than earthly bells. These oscillations trigger small motions, small for the sun, that is, on its surface, creating tremendous up and down drafts that generate broad range of low pitch noises, just as the air blown across a bottle's mouth is set off by notes. Only when the sun, they range into millions, ringing like bells or vibrating like organ pipes. Researchers have been tracking the waves as they resonate from one side of the stars to the other, a journey taking at its fastest 2 hours and 400 times the speed of sound. Just even 2 hours to rotate the sun, like this. Yeah, I don't know what they mean by the speed of sound. See the sound of the sun. When in 2003 I visited the famous old observatory from the outskirts of St. Petersburg, its director asked me, "Would you like to hear the sun?" A moment later I was in the main observation tower listening to a record of that sounded like the nest of alarmed and angry snakes. Nothing gong-like at all, or indeed like breathing. Months later, I read in Kenneth Tristone's diaries the sun that echoes that are not entirely gentle. It hisses. It may be in years to come we will be given a musical work of Tapani and a cobra. Okay, well that's the end of that. And on to chapter 27 and page 275. Only a few hundred pages to go. It's still going at 600 pages, still strong. 609 pages, so that's a fair swank. We get through the 500, 600, so fair busy stuff. So it's interesting to listen to that person having the device of the sun, the theoretical sun, and it is very interesting in that philosophically, I was just thinking about Plato and solar myths and the Parmenides of knowledge and sort of counterculture of Schopenhauer. So I'll have to read, not Schopenhauer himself, but the Wikipedia on Schopenhauer. Okay, well, I'll stop this and get this uploaded. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.